On this week's 51%, we hear about female entrepreneurs.
I wish it were simple as women need to put on their big girl pants and turn into XYZ. And then, of course, the 7% of venture capital that goes to women-led ventures will turn into 85%. But that's not going to happen.
Get a snapshot from a Michelle Obama biographer and listen to a message about women's rights. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
I'm going to be a happy idiot and struggle for the legal tender. Well, the elves take aim and lay their claim to the heart and the soul of the spender.
Joanna Croats has been investigating the payoffs and challenges of small business owners, particularly women-led firms, for years. She's interviewed hundreds of male and female entrepreneurs as a national magazine editor, author and journalist, online small business columnist, and host of a web radio show. Her recently published book is Being Equal Doesn't Mean Being the Same: Why Behaving Like a Girl Can Change Your Life and Grow Your Business. I asked her what changes she has seen in women-led ventures.
The rise of women-owned businesses was really accelerated by the turn of the century and the turn of the 21st century. It was not until the 80s that women were actually allowed to get credit in their own name. Can you believe that? There's a story that NABO, National Association of Women Business Owners, which was in favor and advocate of getting women credit, put out that said one of their members had to get her 13-year-old son to co-sign the loan because for her business, because she was divorced, she didn't have a husband, and there was no other male in the family. I mean, it's just unbelievable. So if you think about it, it's 20 years before the turn of the century. The 90s was about extraordinary growth in technology, all the dot-com, all the affordable tech, plus the recession that pushed a lot of middle managers out of the workforce. So what we see is women who had skills and education and some need for flexibility in their lives because of family care, and they started launching businesses. It was a confluence of money and technology and the economy. In the last several years, we've seen a lot of big marketers, Dell, Amex, Fidelity, those kinds of financial services and technology companies suddenly looking around and seeing that, oh my God, women have wallets. And we now have those kind of marketers going after the women market in terms of women-led ventures. So there's just women have portfolios and skills and education and now a lot of smarts. In some ways, I believe women have more options than men these days. They can stay home and take care of babies. They can start a company that's out of their kitchen table. They can turn into the woman who started Spanx. You know, they have so many more options. Men, I think, in some ways are more rigidly defined. And I think that all of these things have led to women-led ventures. There's also no pressure, I think, on women to scale up. They don't necessarily want to. There are what's called lifestyle businesses, and that's fine. And nobody says women have to be big. When men start businesses, there's an expectation for them to turn into Mark Zuckerberg.
And I wonder, how much does that have to do with, though, the time we're living in, right? And how a lot of things are no inventory for certain services and products, right? And you're doing them, you can run it out of your backpack or your purse or bag or whatever. A lot of very successful companies. I mean, is it a confluence maybe of the time we're in and what you mentioned?
Oh, sure. It's always cultural, sociological, and certainly in the last decade, technological. Women are extremely adept at social media, much more able and willing to use it than men do. I'm still looking at the ROI for social media myself. I'm not alone. I don't quite see it bringing sales to the door or ROI to the bottom line. But as thought leaders, as marketers, as getting out the word, as connecting with peers and colleagues and people who can help, resources from India to Indonesia to Indiana, you now have social media, and women know how to use that. So the networks that used to keep women out in terms of male associations and corporations are now falling by the wayside because women can reach across the land anywhere at any time. And that's been very helpful and, as you say, part of the confluence.
So here we have advancement in the rise in women entrepreneurship, but yet here we are without pay parity and some policies that would be very helpful and maybe some still some cultural perceptions as roadblocks, and I was hoping you could address that.
I can. Unfortunately, it's not cut and dried. I wish it were simple as women need to put on their big girl pants and turn into XYZ, and then, of course, the 7% of venture capital that goes to women-led ventures will turn into 85%, but that's not going to happen. So my feeling is, based on statistics and looking around the culture, is that this is a long road, and this is actually why I think women need to demand more respect from the male side of entrepreneurship, which is a lot about the funders and the people who write about entrepreneurs, and also from other women. I would like to see women funding women. Women now have something like 50% of the wealth in this country, and they're funding the angel investors and the VCs who are women is in a very small minority, maybe 10% of angels and, I don't know, 3% or so of VC. VC meaning venture capital, so it acts like partners, as if it were in a law firm, and that, therefore, is more dependent on men. So I'd like to see them as angels, where they can act as individuals and just invest directly in women-led businesses. But I think here are some reasons why women-led ventures are not advancing. One is this idea that I call the Goldilocks syndrome, which is that women are creating businesses at just the right size for their life right now. Maybe there's a male also in the household earning money, but in any case, they may be working out of their home. They may be doing interim kinds of work that also allows them to take care of relatives or family. And so they don't necessarily want to scale up, and this is always considered a cardinal sin by funders. I'm not so sure. You know, if you have income coming into the family, if your success is defined by going to Machu Picchu and doing yoga as well as having a business, I'm all for it. This is not a very conventional idea of success in terms of what men see as success. Women also tend, not always, but most of the time, tend to form businesses that are transformational, not transactional, by which I mean men define success by how much dough they earned and how big the company gets. Women want purpose, they want passion, and then they want profit. And so, again, this how women define it. We see this in our daily life. Women do not define success in the same way men do. So this is partly what's going on in terms of defining women-led businesses. And then last, of course, is that women tend to launch service businesses, coaching, graphic design, those kinds of catering, fashion services. And these do not scale up very large. They're based on time. They're based on individual one-to-one resources. It's not like creating a widget that you can, you know, some kind of little flash drive that you can now scale up and manufacture. And funders and most of society see success as having that kind of volume as opposed to quality or one-to-one kind of services. I think that's changing again, as we said, because of technology. So women now can reach out and define success with technology helping them to boost businesses. Service businesses are becoming much more scalable, and then the kinds of businesses that are working in the new economy, you know, this new normal of lowered expectations and lowered income, are the kinds of businesses that women do start, which have to do with health, healthcare, education, caring for the elderly, social services. These are all traditionally women kind of sectors, and so I see that changing as well.
What's wrong, though, with defining success differently, that it's not necessarily a dollar figure, that it's success? If I set a goal for myself, I reach it, I'm fulfilled, I feel that the people who are buying my service or product are fulfilled or whatever I'm providing. What's wrong with that? Can we change that definition and then be considered more successful?
Being equal doesn't mean being the same. And the entire message of the book is that we need more respect for the way women behave in business, both in running their own companies and in corporate corridors. This whole idea of the glass ceiling for women in corporations, glass walls, which means they hit the wall when they're entrepreneurs and don't get funding, this is all about, in my mind, not respecting the way women behave and their definition of success. It's inching incrementally away from that male standard, which is, again, transactional, and the yardstick is mostly money and title. There's nothing wrong with it. The problem is there's not enough respect for it. And so as we learn to take account of the ways women do business, and there is more and more I think, acceptance of that, particularly in the millennial generation, everyone will be better off. It's what I call the gender toolbox. If men could take something from women's side of the equation, and women could take something from men, which is they're much better at risk-taking, they're much better at looking at the horizon and seeing what's coming. Women often tend to be myopic about their goals. We'd all be much better off.
What really propelled you to pen this book?
That's a great question, because I'm trying to distill it into a bite-sized notion. Ideas for books tend to be ruminative and generate over time and experience. I think mostly I did not fit in corporate precincts. I was always sitting in, I was a national magazine editor at a half a dozen of national magazines, Money Magazine, Town and Country, so on and so on, Metropolitan Home. And I, particularly in the as you got up the ladder and you more and more encountered male supervisors and men who were in charge, because that's what happens, I would be sitting in these rooms and thinking, what are they talking? I don't feel like I belong here. It's not that I didn't have a skill, but we've all heard the cliches. They turned out to be true. You'd see a woman mention an idea and it would be passed over, and the guy next to her would say the same idea and everyone would nod sagely. Wow, that's really good. Let's do that. And I kept thinking it was my difficult personality. I kept trading up jobs. I did very well. I got better and bigger jobs. I got more and more money. And then I was always tapped as a change agent, because I was looking for something else. So change would not quite happen as well or as fast as I thought it could or should. Mandates for change tend to erode over time. And so I'd trade up to the next job. And so I always thought, oh, it's my personality. And it dawned on me after years of this that it was not that. It was that I was female and outspoken. And those two things did not really mesh too well. So I ended up starting my own business, and it was amazing. My chronic sinus condition cleared up, and the stress level went way down.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
I stopped coming home angry at the world. My kid benefited. And I hear that. I hear virtually identical stories from women who start their own businesses just like this. The studies have done, one after another, that women who run their own show, who start their own businesses, tend to have much more satisfaction in their lives than when they're reporting to to larger structures and larger organizations. And I do think it has to do with doing it your way and having more control over the ways that you run the business. Now, that also leads to other problems, other challenges. Women don't necessarily delegate well when they're running their own show. They don't take on funding and loans when they should, when they could, when they might, and it would grow the business. And I think it comes from seeing that when they were working in larger groups, in larger corporations, they got co-opted or things didn't run the way they wanted to. So there's this kind of sense, I need to hold on, I need to do it my way, I don't trust letting go. But that's, of course, what you have to do as a business owner. By the way, what we didn't touch on is an extraordinary amount of research being generated right now in neuroscience that shows both the brains and the sex hormones of people create different kinds of genetic hardwired traits that are gender-based, that are sex-based in nature. So women's brains have a larger stem that connects the right and left brain, the corpus callosum, and it allows the nerve cells to go, nerve signals to go back and forth much more quickly than men. So we have this idea that women are good at multitasking. That's because they actually, men are like, dear, I'm doing something. Leave me. I got that. I'm putting the lights on. But women do six things at once. And part of it has to do with that kind of brain structure. And then there's hormones. There's just different sex hormones that make for different behaviors.
No, that's really interesting what you point out. I'm not a multitasker. I'm not good at that. So I must have a shorter stem than other women.
This is my favorite time to say, and I should have probably said this about 10 minutes ago. I usually invoke what I call my Miranda warning, which is that there is no such thing as 100% male or 100% female. Nothing. And the latest news about transgender and all these different kinds of third sex options just go to prove that point. It's a continuum. And we have pure male on one side, pure female on the other, and neither exists. But generally speaking, there are characteristics that tend to move toward one or the other sexes, and that's been shown by dozens of studies and academicians and all kinds of things. But none of us are pure in that sense.
That was Joanna Croats speaking about female entrepreneurship. She did mention ROI in the interview, which is return on investment. Croats is the author of Being Equal Doesn't Mean Being the Same, Why Behaving Like a Girl Can Change Your Life and Grow Your Business. While the nation focuses on presidential candidates, we'll have a snapshot look into the early life of First Lady Michelle Obama, expectations surrounding her ascendancy as First Lady, and the impact she will have on the office. We hear this from the perspective of Peter Slevin, former Washington Post bureau chief and author of the biography Michelle Obama, A Life.
I was particularly struck by the way she told stories, told her story. She had a remarkable ability to connect with her audiences. I realized that I wanted to tell her story and to tell it against the history that she lived, which meant starting with Chicago. I'm Peter Slevin. I wrote Michelle Obama, A Life.
Too often, we hear a skewed story about our communities, a narrative that says that a stable, hardworking family in a neighborhood like Woodlawn or Chatham or Bronzeville is somehow remarkable. That a young person who graduates from high school and goes to college is a beat-the-odds kind of hero. And I'm here tonight because I want people across this country to know that story, the real story of the South Side, the story of that quiet majority of good folks, families like mine, who face real challenges but make good choices every single day.
Michelle likes to say that everything she is, everything she became, started in the bungalow where they live, where the Robinsons lived on the top floor when she was growing up in the 1960s and 70s.
The family made a point of sitting down to dinner together every evening. Aunt Robbie gave piano lessons to the children. Frazier made time when he returned from work to play sports with the kids. He gave Craig a pair of boxing gloves and taught him how to use them. Craig remembers boxing with Michelle, who told the International Olympic Committee in Copenhagen that her father taught her how to throw a ball and a mean right hook better than any boy in the neighborhood.
I think one of the reasons that Michelle connects with so many people and that her story resonates with so many people is that it's familiar.
The Brady Bunch was a particular favorite of Michelle's, and she developed an encyclopedic knowledge of the show. The family typically devoted Saturday nights to games, Chinese checkers, Monopoly, a bluffing game called Hands Down, and later epic Scrabble battles. From an early age, Michelle hated to lose.
As she has said in introducing herself in 2007 as part of what could be the first African-American couple in the White House, our story is not that unusual. You just haven't seen it before. You haven't seen us before.
Look, I can't tell you how many times people have met my mother and asked her, well, how on earth did you ever raise kids like Michelle and Craig in a place like South Shore? And my mom looks at these folks like they're crazy. And she says, Michelle and Craig are nothing special. There are millions of Craigs and Michelles out there. And I did the same thing that all those other parents did. She says, I love them. I believed in them, and I didn't take any nonsense from them.
What struck me the most was the way Michelle Obama's upbringing, the lessons she learned along the way, the people with whom she connected became such a strong part of what she's doing now. So much of what she's doing connects with issues of race and class that have been part of her life since she was a girl.
They will make assumptions about who they think you are of the world. And my husband and I know how frustrating that experience can be. The folks who crossed the street in fear of their safety, the clerks who kept a close eye on us in all those department stores, the people at formal events who assumed we were the help.
Virtually overnight, Michelle had become one of the most prominent women in America. The screen was blank, and she was free, if you could call it that, to define a role for herself. Yet she soon discovered that her freedom was defined by a tangle of often conflicting expectations and options.
But as potentially the first African-American First Lady, I was also the focus of another set of questions and speculations, conversations sometimes rooted in the fears and misperceptions of others. Was I too loud or too angry or too emasculated? Or was I too soft? Too much of a mom, not enough of a career woman.
No one who looked like Michelle Obama had ever occupied the White House. No one who acted quite like her either. She ran obstacle courses, she danced the Dougie, she hula-hooped on the White House lawn. She opened the executive mansion to fresh faces and voices and took her show on the road. Her projects and messages reflected a hard-won determination to help the working class and the disadvantaged, to unstack the deck.
I was born and raised here on the South Side in South Shore, and I am who I am today because of this community. I've visited communities just like this one all across the country, communities that face plenty of challenges and crises, but where folks have that same strong work ethic, those same good values, those same big dreams for their kids. But unfortunately, all those positive things hardly ever make the evening news.
It's a challenge to write about someone as public as Michelle Obama is. One thing about people who have reached the pinnacle is we think we know their story because we know what's been presented to us. One of the challenges of writing this book was to figure out, in fact, what we don't know, and also to figure out what we could learn about why she is doing the things she's doing. That was a portrait that was possible to draw. It's a little bit like a pointillist painting where you have a million little dots, and if you look at it very closely, they're just a million little dots of different shades. But if you step back, a picture emerges. I'm Peter Slevin. I wrote Michelle Obama, A Life.
While International Women's Day has come and gone, the global fight for women's rights certainly is not confined to one day. FIDH, or the International Federation for Human Rights, is a non-governmental organization representing 120 countries. Its video for the March 8th day, Being Born a Girl, garnered more than 4 million views and counting.
Being born a girl means clearing a lot of hurdles, and it begins right at the starting line. Sex-selective abortions are frequent in countries like India, where girls are often seen as a financial burden. Discrimination begins even before birth. Sexual mutilation is the fate of at least 200 million girls in 30 countries. It often leads to serious infections and even death. Time for school, for some. In Afghanistan, 90% of women cannot read or write, massively reducing their chances in life. 63 million girls in the world are kept out of school. Before even getting close to adulthood, 700 million girls are forced to get married, often to much older men. Many women go through life without the right to control their own bodies or sexuality. Every year, 22 million women and girls put their health and lives at risk by having unsafe abortions. In some countries, like Senegal, they may end up in jail. Many who make it to adulthood face entrenched discrimination that leads to violence. Way too often, home is not a safe haven, as women are beaten and abused by their own partners. In France, a woman dies of domestic violence every 2.7 days. Even the lucky ones can never stop fighting for equal pay, equal opportunities, and equal rights. Being born a girl means clearing a lot of hurdles.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1393.